Hello everybody and welcome to the Damage Report. Today is Friday, which will become immediately apparent when we go to the wide shot. Hey Brett, how's it going?
It's like Cash Friday. The best part is this is like me and John hanging out with you at like a ski chalet after we got off the slopes.
Exactly.
He's got like a cool jacket on.
I wore this jacket this morning. And I guess it's because it's the holiday week, but the thought of taking it off and putting on a real jacket, not this week.
As I took my flannel, which Edwin describes as the thing I wear on the days when I've given up. big claps. I literally I'm standing by the closet, I look and I see it and I go, F it. And I didn't bleep myself at home, but I literally said out loud, forget it. And I take it and I put this on and I just kind of walk out the door.
And you feel comfortable and warm. I like that.
Yeah. But I love your Arctic suede.
Thank you. It's nice when I have gotten the dog hair off of it. So for a couple of hours, it's nice. And then it's a fur coat, basically.
I want to say some things about Happy Half Hour this week before we do another promo. Mm-hmm. But Happy Half Hour this week, best of episode.
Ooh.
Big announcement, which I think I can make now unless Sophie, no, don't do it.
No big announcements.
All right, no big announcement. Thanks from Sophie.
No.
Next week.
Okay.
That's next week.
But let's do one big announcement. It's not for Happy Half Hour, but this Sunday, you know what you should watch? You should tune into MSNBC. I've never said this before. And you should see Francesca's special. I think we have a little graphic. It is Red, White, and Who with Francesca Fiorentini, Sunday, December 29th, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. It's Francesca, who is awesome. You've probably seen her on the show. She's a great progressive. MSNBC is giving her a shot here. And I would like to provide MSNBC with the right incentives. So let's support Francesca. By the way, on this episode, not only will you have Francesca, but special appearance, little known politician, Bernie Sanders is gonna be on it.
So good. Seen some clips of that, very nice.
Yeah.
Very fantastic.
It's gonna be awesome, but you have to watch it.
And if you can, tweet positive reinforcement to MSNBC while it happens, just to get the true progressive voices out there. You
know? Exactly, because they're putting not only a strong progressive on, but also they're talking about Bernie Sanders. Let's make them super excited about having run this so that they'll hopefully do more and more of these. And maybe, you know, it's a special right now, but maybe Francesca gets a whole show.
And just to clarify, next week we're doing the best of. This week it's a one readinger rerun. We get real drunk talking about Chicago area, suburbia.
Rick?
No.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so look, we also have a show technically. I know you look at us and you think we're just gonna hang out or whatever, but no, we're gonna talk about the news. And so we're gonna be talking quite a bit about campaign finance in a couple of different areas in this Democratic primary, but also Edward Gallagher, the former SEAL that's now been embraced by the MAGA crowd. Some of his former Navy SEALs have done some testifying about him. The New York Times has some videos and some quotes. It is amazing stuff and you're not gonna wanna miss it. But with that, why don't we jump into the first big story of the day involving corruption. So there's this group crew and they are looking for ethics violations in Washington. They've done some great reporting in the past. We've got a good instance of it here. They happen to notice something interesting with hotel prices in the DC area just a couple of weeks ago at a particular hotel. On November 7th, they flagged a massive spike in the cost of a room for December 14th. So looking ahead, they noticed that it was going to be very expensive. So all of the less expensive rooms were sold out. Only the suites were available. And the price was, let's just say it was jacked up a little bit, as you'll notice on this chart. Yeah, that's higher. So
for those of you listening to the podcast version, it looks like a middle finger. Like it's flipping. Every other data point on this chart is very low, except for one that I would say is roughly like 15 times higher.
I think it's 13 times.
So
normally prices at this particular hotel, I believe it's a Trump hotel, about $500, now over $6,700. And so that's interesting. So the minimum cost was 13 times the average and crew couldn't initially identify a reason for the spike until photos later surfaced of the Trump Victory Committee's winter retreat at Trump's hotel on that same night, which appears to have sold out much of the venue. While the least expensive rooms for one night stay were about 500, like we said, 6,700 right there. And so here is what is interesting about this. So you have this hotel, which apparently is generally pretty vacant on most days. Today, or that day I should say, Trump has a big event there. And so lucky donors who managed to snag a room were invited to the White House's holiday open house, meaning that the cost of a room at Trump's DC hotel and donations towards his reelection included exclusive political access for the buyer. To Trump, to Pence, Interior Secretary David Bernhardt, and there were others as well. And so what this effectively means is people go to the hotel, they donate to Trump's reelection. But in going there and in paying massively jacked up prices, like Trump knew that this was the day his big event was gonna be there and they'd want to go. So he elevated the prices by 13 times. That money doesn't go to his reelection, that just goes to him. And all of these people that want access to Donald Trump are now paying thousands and thousands of dollars straight to Trump and his family.
Right, and that's the thing is, some people would hear that and respond, well, that means he's a good businessman. Wouldn't you do the same thing? It's like, yeah, if I was just a businessman, but he's also the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And morally and ethically, it is incumbent upon him to avoid the appearance of impropriety. And like, there's so many things that Trump has done that other presidents have not done. Mm-hmm. And the reason they haven't done it is because it would be wrong to do it. Stuff like this, every other president has divested himself from the very things that could make him money off of his office. That is corruption. It's something that benefits him personally because he has an office that should benefit the people that elected him.
Yeah.
That is corruption. That is what he's doing. And he is, as this chart shows, giving you the middle finger.
Exactly. And look, every president makes money to a greater or lesser extent. I mean, I don't think Carter's like raking it in or whatever. And again, peanut farm.
No, he's raking. Fund. He's raking.
He's
like
literally
leaves.
Raking. He's literally. Yards.
No, he's literally raking and building houses.
Exactly. But like, let's say Obama. So far as I know, Obama never did anything like this while he was in office. But he's certainly making money afterward. And I think a case could be made that that's still. It's not quite right, because the thing is, he's not president anymore. He doesn't have direct executive power, but you can't say he doesn't have any power. But it is obviously different than Trump, who is in office right now, is giving preferential treatment to certain corporations and certain individuals.
So that's how I would look at it. It's like, dude, just wait 8 years. Just
but he can't.
Wait 8 years and you will make. You'll get such a bump in everything. Mm-hmm. All the fakeness that you made money off of, all of that just like selling your name to put on walls. Mm-hmm. Like it you got it. You made it. Big check mark. You're the president of the United States. And you will make an exponentially higher amount of money after you're out of office if you play your cards right. But he doesn't play his cards right. He can't help but cheat at cards. Yeah. That's what this is, and it's very frustrating.
Yeah, and look, Crew has identified other days that there's this same sort of thing happened on the 4th of July and a Senate Republican retreat in November. But this is by far the greatest. And so great work by Crew. They have more details on their website. You can see the authors there on the graphics if you want to go look at the full write-up about this. But yeah, it's just insane. And any reasonable person should think, well, how could it possibly influence you, that money? It would be the same thing. Honestly, if someone were to give me a couple of pennies, that's probably a bigger percentage
not
of my
true.
Net worth.
No, John throws pennies in the trash. It's a very
that's
big
a
point of contention here. He'll take 2 cents and he thinks it, he doesn't even explain it right, but he just throws it in the trash. He's like, I don't need pennies. I just outed you, dude.
I'm not the bad guy, though. I feel like Trump is the bad guy.
Trump's the bad guy. I just think you should have said something that's actually true to your audience.
Okay.
To get back to the point, like they're giving him they're giving him something that he means, like it's a $6,700 a night. A lot of that goes toward the facilities or whatever, but
none if you jack the price up 13
that
times.
That much, because it doesn't cost 13 times more to pay those people.
Exactly.
It's just profit at that point.
It's just free money
but
that goes to Trump.
But from the point of view of someone who is trying to get Trump's influence, that's how they do it. All the time.
Yeah.
That's what it all is. It's all playing the field. It's all donating to campaigns, hoping that some of this, not directly, it's not like, here's this money, give it back to me right now, or I won't give you the money. It's an investment. Like Buttigieg's whole thing is like the investment circle. They're making an investment that they hope will pay off in the future. Yeah. That's how money in politics works. And it's not just donated to campaigns. It's also stuff like this. It's also, that's why the Emoluments Clause exists in the Constitution, because you don't want that stuff floating around there because they can't help but say, oh, you, in Trump's case, you stayed at my hotel, I'm gonna give you a little something in return. Yeah. Or retaliate, not based on if you stay on someone else's property, or retaliate, not in the best interest of the people and national security, but because you didn't stay at my hotel.
Yeah.
Like that's the kind of stuff that the nation was designed by the founders to avoid explicitly.
Yeah, I agree, I agree. Okay, so we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, Democratic primary ad spending is booming, but not evenly, not even close, and we'll show you why after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
As we get closer to Iowa and New Hampshire, ad spending in this Democratic primary is finally starting to really pick up. But if you've been seeing these ads, whether they're on TV or digitally, you're getting anything but a representative idea of who's actually running in this primary. And that is because two people are far outspending all the rest combined. Take a look at this. Together, Tom Steyer and Mike Bloomberg have poured nearly $200 million into television and digital advertising alone, with the former New York mayor spending an unprecedented $120 million in just 3 weeks since he joined the presidential race. Let's just pause for 1 second. That's crazy.
$120 million
in 3 weeks.
I can't even wrap my mind around it. Like, I'll see a movie makes that much in a weekend and it's huge.
Because it's so many people.
But I think of a giant crew, and then when they say all the CGI, I'm like, oh good, these people are getting paid some, blah, blah, blah. With this, you have to factor in like what a vain gesture running is. And
for the vast majority who know they don't really have a chance.
And this, to me, is better than them spending other people's money.
Yes.
Specifically the kind of people that would donate were they running without their own bankroll. Steyer wouldn't be running without, but Bloomberg would probably take Wall Street money in large chunks. This is an investment in his future. But to just say, you know what? Here's $120 million.
Yeah.
Boom.
So like the
It's frequently like accompanied with like, to you, this is $120 million. To them, it's $7.
It's $7, yeah. Yeah. So the analogy that like pops, I think, into most people's heads is that they've effectively set $120 million on fire.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking was, if you actually had $120 million in singles, in 3 weeks, you couldn't burn all of it. It would be too much money to burn all of it.
Yes.
Like, even if you had the gasoline, it's so much money. And to put it in perspective, it's more than double the combined ad spending of all of the other candidates combined over all of this year. Basically, 3 weeks is more than all the other candidates. People who actually have supporters have been spending month after month after month after month.
Yes. Raising it, which is
raising it, which is
a very, we can all agree, annoying part of politics. Not just for people watching it and thinking, oh my God, this is other people's money you're spending, or your own money you're lighting on fire. That's one aspect of it. But like, that isn't even, if you ask the politicians what the most annoying part is of being in politics, they'll tell you, having to raise money. It's most of my time. Yeah. I have to be on the phone. You have to go to the wine cave. I have to eat dinner at the wine cave and rinse and repeat over and over again until I can maybe have what amounts to 1/10 of the money that will eventually be spent compared to these billionaires.
Yeah.
That's one aspect of it. The most like crystallized version of the insanity for me was Steyer making the debate stage. Because in order for Steyer to make the debate stage, he had to do two things. I don't know what the exact numbers were, but I think it was get to like 2% in four polls and raise money from what it was, 100,000 people, say.
It was
probably 60, but it had to be at least 100,000 people. In order to satisfy those two things, he had to spend millions and millions more dollars. So when you think of like your return on an investment to make, to stand on a stage, literally just to stand on the stage, the guy spent, he turned $16 million into $100,000.
Yeah. It's like alchemy where you turn gold into lead.
Yeah, exactly. You go backwards.
It's magical, really.
That is the insanity that is our political system.
Yeah, and Bloomberg isn't even trying. He knows that he's not gonna get the donation, so he's not even trying to get on the stage. I'm gonna talk briefly about what they could have spent the money on, but first, let's see how it is working for them. So first of all, in comparison to Bloomberg, Steyer has spent about $83 million so far. That's small change compared to Bloomberg. The next highest spender on ads is Buttigieg at $19 million. So he has spent quite a bit of money as well, but not nearly as much as these others. So Steyer, he has a 60-person team in South Carolina. That is significant. The largest of his four state operations. He's now in fifth there, 1 percentage point behind Buttigieg. But at least for Steyer, like, he's running on policies that are hypothetically popular, and he's been on the debate stage a couple of times. So it's at least reasonable that he'd be doing well in a state, I guess.
I would say, well, no. The other frustrating thing is that it works. It's less frustrating.
It's a little bit less artificial and frustrating.
Right, but that is a little bit less compared to the giant frustration that is, this works. These two guys, if you watched football this any weekend, you were bombarded by television ads from Bloomberg and then to a lesser extent Steyer. Just telling you this, telling you. Steyer before that, impeach, impeach, impeach. So he was investing money in getting to know you, probably knowing he would eventually run for president way back then. So in the grand scheme, he spent way more than this.
Yeah.
And the frustrating thing is he had to hit those thresholds and polls. So if you just bombard the airwaves with ads, it will get you to a qualifying level.
A couple of points.
That is crazy. Yeah,
it is crazy. Now, so he has a strategy where he's putting a bunch of money in the first four states, and so far it doesn't look like an amazing strategy because he's in fifth in South Carolina. Okay, that's cool. That's it. But Bloomberg has a different strategy. He's spending far more money. He's spending in all 50 states, but is especially targeting big delegate-rich Super Tuesday states. He spent more than $13 million on advertising in California alone, which, remember, Buttigieg was third in spending with $19 million. Bloomberg has spent almost as much as the third place person in just California, which offers 416 delegates. He's also spent more than $13 million each in Texas and Florida. And these are effectively, with Super Tuesday and a week from Super Tuesday together, a very big part of the delegates that you would like to have. Now, we don't have enough polls to say whether that's working, and my gut says that it probably isn't. But in theory, this could be a way to not have to go on the debate stage. He doesn't have to perform well in the first four states. But if he's spending, he's dumping tens of millions of dollars in these states, and other people aren't even advertising there yet, it's not impossible that it could work.
It is impossible. It could work.
It's mostly impossible. I don't think it's going to work.
Mark my words, it won't work.
Okay.
And then, but I do want to take a minute to just be like, I kind of like Steyer.
Yeah, I like him a lot more than Bloomberg.
To have him on the stage. Like when there was a time when there were 700 people on the stage, I was like, all right.
It's too much. So
a lot of you aren't adding literally anything, but it is. At least he's not. He's taken time to talk to TYT when he's on the in the spin rooms and
that's
everything.
True. That's true.
And what he's saying is like, yeah, the system has effed you for years, and I want to fix it. And that's a really refreshing thing to say. Whether he should be president or not, very different conversation. But at the very least, I thought I was going to hate Steyer, and I don't hate Steyer.
Not nearly as much. He's not a Bloomberg. He's not a Schultz. Okay, yeah. He's a little bit different than them. Okay, so we're going to take a short break. When we come back, that trick that Brett was talking about that Steyer had to pull, we've got a sort of version of that with Pete Buttigieg, which we'll reveal after this. The past month or so of news in this Democratic primary for Pete Buttigieg about his fundraising has not necessarily gone exactly like he would have wanted. And now his team is making things a little bit harder for him too. And it has to do, I think, with his average donation, the amount, and the fact that it's a little bit too high and they don't like that. So let's look at the numbers as they stand. Through three quarters of fundraising, that's the majority of 2019, his average donation was around $40. Significantly higher than the $18 and $27 averages of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Not the highest we've ever seen, but significantly higher. It's more than twice as much as Bernie Sanders. And so we can't say for sure that this is the goal, but Brett is going to comment. The Pete for Innovation team put out an email with a little game that they wanted donors for Pete to play. And here's a section of that email. All you have to do to win this contest is donate the smallest amount that nobody else donates. In other words, suppose you donate $1. If someone else playing also donated exactly $1, you both lose. We'll see if only one player donated $1.01, and so on until we found an amount donated exactly once, and that's our winner. That's it. Those are the rules. Only donations that are part of this contest count. From this email, and let's be real, we might send you a reminder or two, but that's it. Multiple donations are allowed and encouraged. Wink, wink. Just be creative. Pick a unique donation amount, and you could win. So the belief that a lot of people have is that this is sort of an artificial way to get people who are already donating to artificially send in low donations. And with the power of mathematics, the average donation will then go down. But it's a part of a game, you see.
I would like to say that in the early days of Pete Buttigieg, I was assigned to watch his town hall and
live stream
it. After you watched the, I forget who, and that's the point, they're no longer in the race anymore, town hall.
Might have been Beto O'Rourke.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't Beto. It was the guy, the healthcare guy, healthcare millionaire guy.
Bullock?
No. See, exactly, Bennett. It was Michael Bennett. That's what you had to do. Anyways, nice guy. But I watched the Buttigieg one, and I liked him. Mm-hmm. And I found out back then that he did write like a high school essay he won an award for about Bernie Sanders. And I was like, okay, this guy's cool. And that was back when he's like Medicare for all that stuff. I have grown to have such a distaste for Pete Buttigieg because of stuff like this. Because explicitly of stuff like this. The idea that he wants to put out this aura of like, I'm just a man of the people. I am one of those like trying to make it. I'm a progressive just like you. But everything is so fake. He tries to say, you know, back in the day, he said, I want to get money out of the treasurer's race. We found that video. And he said, I think money in politics corrupts. And
he doesn't
want
banks coming in and donating and trying to buy the election.
Doesn't want all that stuff. He knows it, but he knows that he can't win with that message because of all these half steps he's taken in the meantime.
Well, look, so maybe this is a weird
fake
thing to even say. We don't know for sure that he couldn't have won without it if a few other things were different.
Yeah.
If he actually was a Bernie Sanders loving, Medicare for all supporting, super young mayor who plays the piano and speaks Norwegian or whatever, if he had entered the race and gotten the huge amount of media that he got and was a strong progressive, Who knows? I don't think that he would have won, but it's not impossible. It's he apparently made the calculation, or maybe it's an accurate reflection of his values, we don't know, that he doesn't actually support those things.
No.
And he needs to raise money from people who definitely don't support those things.
And you see it, man. You see it on the debate stage when someone confronts him and he wants to have, the thing about Buttigieg is he has this rehearsed like cadence. Everything I'm saying, I'm trying to say from the heart. And he really wants to get to that thing where he can recite his memorized messaging, right? However, if someone challenges him in the right way, you'll see him about to explode at the seams as he tries to pivot to that memorized thing. And this is that weird, fake, memorized thing he's trying to get to, which is I want to be able to say my average donation is smaller than other people's donations. Mm-hmm. He wants to be able to say that. And he's willing to do whatever it takes to be able to say that. He has bad optics on the wine cave, which was a brilliant messaging turn by Elizabeth Warren to call out the wine cave and everybody who did, but to call out the wine cave. He wants to say that he's got all those pedigrees of the Bernie Sanders's, who have a subscription model that is brilliant. That is the actual brilliant way to get small dollar donations, which should be how our politics works.
Yeah.
Is more people donate, you have that win. But in order to overcome the bad optics of having higher average donations, that something like this happens. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't realize that the optics on this are just as bad, if not worse, because he can't just say, I want everyone out there to give a small donate, to give whatever you can. He can't just say that because, as you said, he's already muddied the waters on what the hell this guy stands for by changing since we first met him. And we only met him 10 minutes ago. Imagine you're on a date with someone and they say, I'm a doctor. And then 10 minutes later, I'm a lawyer. Well, I watch lawyer shows on TV. That's where we're at with Pete Buttigieg. So all over the place, and we can't trust him. So even if this was something that someone who worked on their campaign realized by working on a previous campaign works in order to just raise more money from more people, whether that's the case or not, because of the wine cave, because of his try-hard attitude.
Hiding the bundlers. Initially stopping media from coming into his fundraisers.
All of these things contribute to me looking at this and saying, that's what it's about.
Yeah, and look, I get that there are people probably watching this that are like, you're being unfair to Pete Buttigieg, I like Pete Buttigieg. And I'm sure, look, every candidate has fans, obviously. He's polling at a couple percentage points, I get that. But we don't hide who we support, and we don't pretend to support people that we don't. That's like this thing that really bothers me in the media, where I guess to get fans, you pretend to support candidates that you don't. I don't, okay? I'm not pretending to like Klobuchar, Gabbard, or him either. I don't. He does skeeve me out. And like you said, I see the way he delivers lines on the stage, the way he responds to criticism, the way he attacks. It reads as very artificial politician to me. And we watch a lot of debates. And yes, we acknowledge that we're biased. I don't know if you've officially endorsed someone. I have officially endorsed Bernie Sanders. So I get that I'm biased. But this is like, if you are going to be super sketchy about one topic, don't have it be your fundraising and who you're making promises to and who's raising money for you, because that trickles out to literally everything else. And he has had one bad news story after another. Some are missteps from his team, but some are his issues. He has brought this on himself.
Yeah. The only reason I can see to support Pete Buttigieg is if you're a socially, and I don't necessarily like everyone who says these things, but if you're a socially progressive person who wants a younger candidate, and you think that a quick change to Medicare for all will ruin the economy. Like that's it. You have to genuinely believe that. Like I've talked to doctors who like Pete Buttigieg, and those doctors say, yeah, I can't Medicare for all because I don't like the reimbursement rates. There's the reason I got it. I don't think looking at their interpretation of the medical system that it is a good idea. Mm-hmm. Like you have to not like Medicare for all if you like Pete Buttigieg. Yeah. That's the only earnest people I've seen. But even those people don't know much about him. I bring up did you know that there are very few like people of color who support Pete Buttigieg? And maybe it's tied, like here, read some of our reporting on him.
Yeah.
They don't know any of that.
Yeah.
And it's the low people who don't pay that much attention to politics who are literally in the medical industry and are benefiting from the system as it exists. Yeah.
And you'd have to be okay with the fact that he used to say that he was hardcore for Medicare for All.
And live in California and New York, yeah.
Probably. Okay, so we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to.
Start stabbing him.
So what you're seeing there is an interview with a Navy SEAL who served with Edward Gallagher, a Navy SEAL who'd been accused of war crimes and is now a favorite on the right. And that's really why we're talking about Edward Gallagher once again, the combination of these two things. We have people who served with him going on the record about their impressions of who he was and the fact that he is now, and you can expect all next year, going to be out front in support of Donald Trump. I mean, take a look at this picture. There he is hanging out over the holidays at Mar-a-Lago with Donald Trump and the First Lady. This is a guy who's been accused of multiple war crimes and has become a hero on the right, either because they think he didn't do it or, in my view, because he's been accused of multiple war crimes. And we're gonna have a whole bunch of sections of these New York Times interviews with him. Just initially, what do you think about the fact that he has been lifted up by the right and by Trump, especially, who's tweeted numerous times about this guy?
It actually kind of crystallizes what Trump, for me, what Trump probably looks for in someone. It's not just whether they're good or bad in his eyes. It's whether the other side is saying something different about them in the meantime. I think that's what this is about. I think if there wasn't, because we heard basically the case against Eddie Gallagher was that he did all this stuff. We just hadn't seen the video evidence of actual other soldiers saying it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think that's what Trump gravitates toward, is not just like this is a soldier. He would otherwise he would have just picked a soldier. He would have picked a soldier who did good things and was a hero.
Yeah.
But instead, he found a soldier that everyone else was saying is a bad guy.
Specifically for killing Muslim civilians indiscriminately.
Yes, in a way that
not
is
all
expedient to him.
Civilians.
And that's where it all comes together. He's doing things that people are calling him evil for, that people are calling you evil for. They think that you're anti-Muslim, but you're not. You're just protecting America. The same way these guys are saying this guy's anti-Muslim, but he's not. He's just protecting America. They're coming to us. Now read my tweet where it's like they're coming for you, but I'm the one in between you and them. That's what this is about. We're strong, but we're embattled.
Yeah, well, in this case, the people that are coming for him are Navy SEALs who served with him and witnessed what he did. So we're gonna read some of what was revealed in the New York Times piece that is now available. You can read all about it. They say in cramped interview rooms in San Diego, SEALs who spoke to Navy investigators painted a picture of a platoon driven to despair by a chief who seemed to care primarily about racking up kills. They described how their chief targeted women and children and boasted that, quote, burqas were flying. So we have a couple of real standout quotes here. Again, this is not from people who heard about what he, these are people who served with him. So, asked whether the chief had a bias against Middle Eastern people, Special Operator Scott replied, I think he just wants to kill anybody he can. Special Operator Miller told investigators, the guy is freaking evil. Special Operator First Class Joshua Vriens, a sniper, said the guy was toxic. And Special Operator First Class Corey Scott, a medic, said, you could tell he was perfectly okay with killing anybody that was moving. And look, I don't know firsthand much about the culture of Navy SEALs, but I keep reading over and over that they generally do not criticize one another about the things that they do in the field. It is a big thing for them to come forward on the record with their name and just think about what they must have gone through, what they must have seen to come to the point where they feel like we have got to say something about this guy.
Yeah, and it's a lot of them. That's the question. That's the central question I've had for a very long time, is how much truth do you need before you believe it? That's what we're giving you. This is a lot of truth at you. The only people who are defending Eddie Gallagher are Eddie Gallagher. We should probably get rid of that because that's himself. Of course you can, but the other people who are SEALs, by the way. The Navy SEALs you revere. The brave soldier, the person on the wall watching out for you.
Yep.
There's a lot of them. There's more of them saying this guy was evil than someone who is him I need other character witnesses for him.
Well, there's Pete Hegseth, Fox and Friends.
Pete Hegseth, who doesn't know him. The other people have every incentive in the world to not acknowledge this at this point.
Yeah.
Because they're already all in for him.
Yeah. Well, because a couple of different things, which as we've talked about this over the past few months, keeps coming up. One, he was killing Muslims. We can pretend that everybody equally thinks that that's a bad thing. I don't think that we equally think that's a bad thing. And two, there's some people who don't like the precedent that we would be calling out our own soldiers if they commit war crimes.
We have for a long time.
Exactly, but some people are uncomfortable with that. I don't think they like the idea that we would acknowledge war crimes that are committed by our side. And so let's talk a little bit more about what he did. So some of the SEALs said they came to believe that so really fast, before we get to this graphic, the reason this is interesting is it is not just that Trump is lifting up a guy of all the soldiers he could campaign with who has been accused of multiple war crimes. It's that in doing it, and the guy he chose, both of those endangered other soldiers, endangers the morale of the military, all of that. Like as we've been talking over the past month, him continually overriding military leadership to protect this guy hurts the military. But he doesn't care because he cares more about this accused war criminal than he does about the military. And take a look at what the effect this guy had when he was serving. So some of the SEALs said they came to believe that the chief was purposefully exposing them to enemy fire to bait ISIS fighters into revealing their positions. They said the chief thought that casualties in the platoon would increase his chances for a Silver Star. Now you can say that they're wrong. Sure, they could be wrong. I don't know. I wasn't there. But they apparently believed that he did not care if they lived or died, if it gave him a chance to gun down enemy soldiers and make him look impressive to the higher ups.
And he has been deemed impressive by the highest up.
Mm-hmm.
And all the incentives now are to do stuff like this, are for people like this. And you know who it dissuades from joining up to actually do the things that like you would think a soldier would want to join up for? It dissuades all the ones who are doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And incentivizes all the people who'd be doing it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, and that's the people inside of the US. Now think about people in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Yemen and all of these different places. Think about what they will think when they see that the President of the United States has chosen to invite to his Christmas party and share eggnog with, and soon he'll be campaigning with him. He chose, of all the soldiers, a guy who gleefully executed, captured ISIS fighters. What message does that send to potential allies abroad, to potential enemies abroad? That we, if someone is believed to have killed civilians, this guy is accused of gunning down purposefully an old man, a teenage girl, firing wildly into civilian areas just for fun to see what would happen. That this is the guy that Trump lifts up. What message does that send to everyone in these areas of the world that we insist that we're gonna continue to be involved with?
And I guarantee you, along the way, he said central casting.
Almost certainly, he just
looks like a cartoon of a soldier you believe in. And he looks great in his uniform. His wife's a knockout, like that kind of stuff. Like he says stuff like that. And we're gonna have them with us. Make sure he wears all the ribbons he gets. Can we put more on him?
Yeah. Yeah, and by the way, like the things he's accused of doing, like again, the pro-life people, they're not gonna care, they're gonna love it. That could be Congressman Gallagher in a couple of years. You don't think that they would do that? You don't think that he could be like, he could be put into a position of leadership in the military by Trump, that he wouldn't just lift him up and make him Secretary of Defense? What does he care? He doesn't respect any of these offices. War criminal, whatever, he looks the part, put him in there.
And in the coverage. But Trump insists that all these allegations are false.
Exactly. And so let's go to Edward Gallagher, who said this through his lawyer. My first reaction to seeing the videos was a surprise and disgust that they would make up blatant lies about me. But I quickly realized that they were scared that the truth would come out of how cowardly they acted on deployment. So understand, you can say what this thing they say was a lie, this thing's a lie. We have the photo of him posing in front of the dead ISIS fighter that he killed with a knife. So he's pretending that this is all made up, blatant lies, and that they're being cowardly. There was a guy who was being treated by a medic, was knocked out. He takes out his knife and goes up and stabs the guy to death. But everyone else are cowards. And by the way, do you know that knife? I learned something about this story today. So when he was retired, he posted on an Instagram about this new hatchet he got from a guy who makes knives and other sorts of weapons. So that guy had made a knife for him in the past. It was the knife he brought to war and used to kill this guy. Before going there, he had posted that he wanted to put it into someone's skull. That's the sort of sociopath that we're supposed to believe. All of these other SEALs, they're just making up gossip and lies about him. A guy who bragged that he wanted to murder someone with this knife, and he found an opportunity, not in combat, not, you know, in the thick of it, but there was a person who was knocked out, being treated by a medic, and he decided to execute him with his knife.
It's messed up.
It's sick. It's sick. In the last few years, a lot of bad stuff has happened. It's difficult for something to really stand out. But Trump and 32% of this country embracing a guy, not despite him being accused of war crimes, but specifically because he was accused of war crimes, that stands out as particularly disgusting. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back a little bit more to close out the show. So recently, in the run-up to the holidays, apparently there were scares of measles at a number of different airports, five different airports. And because of that, it got people thinking about measles once again, and also talking about it on the news, sometimes in a way that's helpful, sometimes not. We've got a mix of those two here. Take a look at the way Fox covered this issue.
A little bit nervous about that now, so we might do some sanitation when we get home.
I am pro-vaccination, so I feel like, you know, you protect others by doing that, you protect your own family by doing that. I know adult measles just not good.
Measles is not a big deal to me at all. When I was a child, I had the measles. It's an insignificant disease, and I think it's stupid that people are making such a big deal out of it.
Bro. I know some anti-vaxxers.
Why would you do that? Yes, you could stick a mic in someone's face, and some of them will be reasonable, and some of them will be crazy. You can do that. You can do that about literally anything. You don't have to put it on your show without adding some context, perhaps, which we're gonna have. And I have gone out of my way to get Fox News being right on this issue.
Go for it.
But okay, so let's do it. So you know why this is a bad thing, okay?
Measles? Is it because it's a very preventable disease?
That
too. We fixed it. So it's like the rabies fun run in the office. It's like, no, we can fix it now. Just do that.
You're talking about the Meredith rabies Palmer Memorial Fun Run for the cure. So look, there they had people saying they're scared of measles and it's bad, and they're preparing, and some people saying you shouldn't worry about it. What that is not balance. It's misinformation, and that's dangerous. As was noted by Fox when they had this headline, CDC, record measles outbreak fueled by anti-vaccination propaganda. You know, like the biggest news channel in the world saying, maybe not so bad. And so it is bad. Dr. Mark Escott, medical director for Austin Public Health, said, it's an acute, highly contagious viral disease. A small number of cases are capable of quickly producing epidemics. And the way you get that small number of cases is convincing a small number of people that they don't need to get vaccinations or give them to their family members. And it being a harmless thing, this sort of reliance on anecdotal personal information, like, okay, maybe you had measles or something. But did you know that in 1980, 2.6 million people died of measles? By 1990, that had fallen to a little bit over 500,000. By 2014, global vaccination programs had reduced the number of deaths from measles to 73,000. That number is apparently now going back up again because people are not taking the vaccinations, aren't giving them to their kids.
Here's what I don't see, because I know someone who posts, I have all kinds of friends, and one of them posts Jews for Jesus stuff. I don't understand why. The other one posts anti-vax stuff, and it's just memes. And those memes say, here are twins, and those twins were healthy. It's just a picture of twins. And then they got vaccines and then they died. A, that's just a meme. Where's the rest of it? Mm-hmm. Like, you just saw something and you reposted it because in a weirdly, we incentivize contrarianism because it's cool. It makes you feel different and part of a community. Like, that's why they post it without looking into it. Also, like, yeah, so that's one. Here's 2.8 million people that we can save because we have a cure for it.
Well, we did save a lot of people.
That's what I'm saying. Like, those numbers prove that yearly we saved 2 million people.
Yeah.
Done. Yeah. That's your answer. That's my counterpoint to your point.
Exactly. Done. That's your answer. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Tune in this Sunday to Red, White, and who? Francesca Fiorentini, obvious friend of the show on MSNBC. Please watch, please tweet at MSNBC and Francesca at Frenifio about how much you liked it. Thank you for joining us throughout the week, Brett. Always glad to have you here.
Mostly good to be here.
Mostly good. Yeah.
I feel bad about the money thing, throwing it in the trash.
Yeah, well, let's just talk about it more then.
It's just 2 cents.
Okay, I'll see you on Monday, everybody. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.